Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the Wednesday, January 19th reading of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head. Today we will be reading the following main articles. COVID-19 surge. U.S. faces wave of Omicron deaths in the coming weeks, models say, by Carla K. Johnson, the Associated Press. Traffic in 2021, death totals raise alarm by Elise Schmelzer, the Denver Post. In Colorado State House, GOP votes to thank January 6th crowd, back Peters by Alex Burness and Saja Hindi, the Denver Post. U.S. faces wave of Omicron deaths in coming weeks, models say, by Carla K. Johnson, the Associated Press. The fast-moving Omicron variant may cause less severe disease on average, but COVID-19 deaths in the U.S. are climbing, and modelers forecast 50,000 to 300,000 more Americans could die by the time the wave subsides in mid-March. The seven-day rolling average for daily new COVID cases in the U.S. have been trending upward since mid-November, reaching nearly 1,700 on Monday, still below the peak of 3,300 in January 2021. COVID-19 deaths among nursing home residents started rising slightly 2 weeks ago, although still at a rate 10 times less than last year before most residents were vaccinated. Despite signs of Omicron causes milder disease on average, the unprecedented level of infection spreading through the country, with cases still soaring in many states, means many vulnerable people will become severely sick. If the higher end of projections comes to pass, that would push total U.S. deaths from COVID-19 over 1 million by early spring. A lot of people are still going to die because of how transmissible Omicron has been, said University of South Florida epidemiologist Jason Salimi. It's unfortunate it's going to get worse before it gets better. Morgues are starting to run out of space in Johnson County, Kansas, said Dr. Sanmi Ariola, director of the health department. More than 330 residents have died in the county this year, the vast majority of them unvaccinated. But the notion that a generally less severe variant could still take the lives of thousands of people has been difficult for health experts to convey. The math of it, that a small percentage of very high number of infections can yield a very high number of deaths, is difficult to visualize. Overall, you're going to see more sick people even if you as an individual have a lower chance of being sick, said Catriona Shea of Pennsylvania State University, who co-leads a team that pulls together several pandemic models and shares the combined projections with the White House. The wave of deaths heading for the United States will crest in late January or early February, Shea said. In early February, weekly deaths could equal or exceed the Delta peak and possibly even surpass the previous U.S. peak in deaths last year. Some unknown portion of these deaths are among people infected with the Delta variant, but experts say Omicron is also claiming lives. This is Omicron-driven, Shea said, of the coming wave of deaths. The combined models project 1.5 million Americans will be hospitalized and 191,000 will die from mid-December through mid-March. Taking into account the uncertainty in the models, U.S. deaths during the Omicron wave could range from 58,000 to 305,000. Yet it's become increasingly clear that the risk from Omicron is lower than from previous variants. New evidence from nearly 70,000 patients in Southern California suggests Omicron is causing milder illness than Delta. A study posted online and cited during a recent White House briefing found patients with Omicron had a 53% lower risk of hospitalization with respiratory symptoms, a 74% lower risk of ICU admission, and a 91% lower risk of death. The study, which has yet been peer-reviewed, comes from researchers at Kaiser Permanente and University of Colorado Berkeley. It's hard for me to say straight out it's good news, said study co-author Sarah Y. Tartoff, a Kaiser Permanente research scientist. Maybe there's good news in the sense that if you are infected, your chance of becoming severely ill are decreased, but from a societal perspective, it's a very heavy burden for us. It remains a serious situation, and we need to maintain practices and behaviors we know protect us. Overburdened hospitals could also contribute to more deaths, said Mark Lipsitch of Harvard, T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and science director at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Forecasting Center. In places with extremely short staffing and overloads of patients, as the medical professionals have been telling us, the quality of care begins to suffer, Lipsitch said. That may also lead to higher death rates, but it's not in any of the models that I'm aware of. Colorado State House. GOP votes to thank January 6th crowd back Peters by Alex Burness and Saja Hindi, the Denver Post. Two-thirds of Colorado House GOP members voted Tuesday in favor of formally thanking State Rep. Ron Hanks and those who joined him at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th at the U.S. Capitol. A majority of House Republicans also voted to call into question whether Joe Biden was legitimately elected, to urge the decertification of 2020 election results in an effort to reinstall former President Donald Trump, to support embattled Mesa County and recorder Tina Peters, an ally of election deniers who is under investigation for allegedly allowing a security breach in her elections divisions, and to commit an ensuing dead people are removed from voter rolls, something from which there is already a process in Colorado. Each of these proposals came as amendments to H.R. 22-1004, a resolution brought by Colorado Democrats who want to urge Congress to adopt voting rights legislation. Democrats control the House and easily defeated each Republican amendment, ultimately passing the resolution on strict party lines. Lawmakers often jokingly refer to resolutions as letters to Santa, that is, messages that will never land. That's surely the case here, as the Democrats have no apparent path to passing voting rights legislation without abolishing the filibuster. Democratic Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona have made it clear they will not support that action. And so the Colorado resolution functions mainly as a chance for politicians to take a side on record on the matters of elections and voting rights. The resolution passed 20-13 in the Senate, with all Republicans but Henderson's Kevin Priola voting no and all Democrats voting yes. Hanks, a Fremont County Republican and candidate to challenge Democratic U.S. Senator Michael Bennett in November, attended Trump's rally on January 6th, and then marched to the U.S. Capitol, sparking a Colorado House Democrat to call for his removal early last year. He spoke well Tuesday of the people he met in D.C. "They were such nice people, Mr. Speaker," he said. "These people did nothing wrong. They were afraid for our country." The Republicans who voted for the amendment to support Hanks, which also called for the removal of dead people from voter rolls, were Reps. Mark Baisley of Roxborough Park, Rod Bockenfeld of Watkins, Mark Catlin of Montrose, Richard Holthoff of Akron, Stephanie Luck of Penrose, Patrick Neville of Castle Rock, Rod Pelton of Cheyenne Wells, Andres Pico of Colorado Springs, Janice Rich of Grand Junction, Shane Sandridge of Colorado Springs, Matt Soper of Delta, Tanya Van Bieber of Eaton, Kevin Van Winkle of Highlands Ranch, Perry Will of Newcastle, Dave Williams of Colorado Springs, and Dan Woog of Erie. Representatives who voted against were House Minority Leader Hugh McKean of Loveland, Mary Bradfield of Colorado Springs, Terry Carver of Colorado Springs, Colin Larson of Littleton, and Mike Lynch of Wellington. Hanks recused himself from the vote, and Tim Geithner of Colorado Springs and Kim Ransom of Douglas were both excused from the vote. The Speaker, Democrat Alec Garnett of Denver, shouted from the House lectern after all Republican amendments were defeated. In Colorado, we cannot remain silent. Did you see those amendments? The choice is clear. The choice is clear between the two groups of elected representatives in this building today, he said. Holy moly, we cannot remain silent. We cannot remain silent. Colorado, America, listen up. This is serious. You are under threat. Your ability to vote is under threat. McKean made clear how far apart he is from so many in that caucus then when, toward the end of Tuesday's debate, he said, folks, Joe Biden won the election in 2020 just like Donald Trump won in 2016. The minority leader allies himself with a relatively moderate flank of his party, which promoted Hanks and several others to unsuccessfully try to oust him from leadership after the last session. McKean stresses mainstream issues like taxes and public safety, always downplaying the extent to which election denialism and other far-right pursuits are factors in the caucus he leads. Prior to the vote, the House GOP sent out a statement slamming Democrats for bringing this resolution in the first place, calling it an epic waste of everyone's time to relitigate the election. It is improper to spend time on this issue so soon after a holiday marking the birthday of Martin Luther King Jr., the statement read. King fought for voting rights before his assassination, and his family this year asked people not to celebrate the holiday unless and until Congress passes voting rights legislation. We cannot celebrate Dr. King's birthday while standing idly by, Democratic Senator Kerry Donovan of Vail said during the Senate's much shorter and more reality-based discussion. You cannot just tweet. You cannot just give a speech. You cannot just show up on a holiday and post a picture. Traffic in 2021. Death totals raise alarm, by Elise Schmelzer. State mark hits two-decade high, State Patrol says it's a crisis, the Denver Post. More people died in crashes on Colorado's roads last year than any other year in nearly two decades, prompting highway officials to call for drivers to change the way they act to reverse the tragic trend. At least 672 people died in traffic crashes last year, though Colonel Matthew Picard, chief of the Colorado State Patrol, said he expects the number to exceed 700 once the year's data is finalized. Driving is the most dangerous activity many Coloradans do on an average day, despite the fact that nearly all crash deaths are preventable, he said in a Tuesday news conference. The number of deaths last year is 50% higher than the number recorded in 2011, and the highest on record since 2002, data compiled by the Colorado Department of Transportation shows. This is a crisis in our state, Picard said. This is a crisis we're dealing with across the country, and I don't use that word lightly. Packard and other officials attributed the rise in deaths to the driver's lack of personal responsibility. Too many people are driving while impaired, using excessive speeds, and allowing themselves to be distracted behind the wheel, he said. Colorado's population and the number of people using its roads have increased in the last two decades, but they have not risen at the same rate as the number of crash deaths, said John Lorm, Director of Maintenance and Operations for the Colorado Department of Transportation. Traffic deaths increased in 2020 from 2019, even as the use of Colorado roads plummeted during the beginning of the pandemic, he said. Drivers must do their part, Lormie said. At least 246 of the 2021 2021's traffic deaths, or 37%, involved an impaired driver, up from 212 such deaths in 2020. Data about which substances drivers were using last year has not been available because toxicology reports can take months, Colorado Department of Transportation spokesman Sam Cole said. The department will publish a report when the data is final. The final number of deaths caused by distracted drivers also was not yet available, Cole said. Officials urge Coloradans to use seatbelts while traveling. At least 226 of the people who died in traffic crashes last year were not wearing seatbelts, or a third of the total deaths. The five counties with the highest number of crashes are some of the state's most populous: El Paso, Adams, Denver, Jefferson, and Arapaho. Of those counties, El Paso is the only one to see a decrease from 2020 and no growth from the average number of deaths from the prior 3 years. Adams, Denver, and Jefferson counties each saw a 14% increase from their three-year averages, and Arapaho saw a 10% increase. Though the state's most populous counties have the highest number of crash fatalities, Packard said the rise in deaths is also being seen in more rural areas. Some of the state's most dangerous stretches of road include Interstate 25 in Douglas County, Interstate 70 between Eisenhower Tunnel and Glenwood Canyon, and U.S. 160 and U.S. 550 in southwest Colorado, and Interstate 76 through northeast Colorado, Packard said. The increase in crash deaths in Colorado matches nationwide trends. More than 20,000 people died in car crashes in the U.S. in the first 6 months of 2021, the largest number recorded in that six-month period since 2006, according to U.S. Department of Transportation National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Street racing and road rage continue to plague Colorado highways, officials said. Packard said that the road rage incidents cause crashes nearly every day. You gain nothing engaging in that type of an argument going down the highway at 65, he said. Officials emphasized that while law enforcement interventions are a deterrent, there could never be enough officers or troopers to cover all the miles of Colorado's roads. I stopped a lot of cars in my career, and the fine is part of that. Consequences are important to stop this behavior, but if 700 lives lost, it isn't a deterrent. I don't know what is, Packard said. Refund threatens immigration status of foreign investors. Vermont regulators take aim at Vail Resorts, by Sam Tabachnik, the Denver Post. Vermont regulators this month issued a cease and desist order to Vail Resorts, alleging that the Colorado-based ski giant is reneging on an agreement with roughly 30 immigrant investors who could lead to their deportation. These foreign investors came to the United States under EB-5 Immigrant Investor Program, created by Congress in 1990 to facilitate economic development in exchange for the chances to receive a green card or permanent U.S. residency status. In 2014, more than 100 people invested $500,000 with Peak Resorts, which Vail Resorts bought in 2019 for the purposes of building an improved ski lodge and upgraded snowmaking facility at Mount Snow in southern Vermont. In return for their capital and job creation, the investors received temporary residency with the ability to become permanent U.S. residents in the future. But Vermont regulators in their January 7th order said Vail Resorts is trying to return money to dozens of investors involved in the Mount Snow project before their immigration petitions have been processed by the federal government, which the state argued would violate Vermont security laws and could result in investors losing their legal status to remain in the country. If your application hasn't been decided yet and you get refunded, you're out of possibilities to get your permanent green card, said Michael S. Pichek, commissioner with the Vermont's Department of Financial Regulation, which filed a cease and desist order. That's a very serious outcome for these investors. Quinn Kelsey, a Vail Resort spokesperson said in a statement that the company is evaluating our legal recourse, but that is confident our practices are fully compliant. Since the Mount Snow EB-5 project's formation in 2014, our communications with investors have been transparent, clear, and compliant with securities laws, Kelsey said. Vail Resorts did not respond when asked why it is refunding the Mount Snow investors. These investments are primarily an avenue for people to get a coveted green card rather than make a significant return on investment, Pichak said. The state became aware of the refunds in late November and early December when investors told them they had been contacted by Vail Resorts asking them to complete a form with bank wire transfer instructions. These investors were told at the time of their investment that their money would not be returned if it would negatively impact their immigration status, Pichak said. Now, Vail threatens to do the exact opposite. Vail Resorts told Vermont regulators in December that the company intended to proceed with refunds over the state's objections, according to the cease and desist order. We are struggling to understand why this is their position, Pichak said, from a moral, ethical, or legal standpoint. The department is proceeding at the administrative level for the moment, Pichak said, though it has the ability to escalate the case to state or federal court if needed. Under Vermont law, the state can issue $15,000 fines per violation. Complicating matters is the fact that the EB-5 program was not reauthorized by Congress, meaning these investors could not simply apply for a new project. The U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services said it will still process petitions for permanent resident status. Again, I will not accept your plan to liquidate as it is a violation of the agreement and also irresponsible to and disrespectful of fellow Mount Snow investors, and I will take legal actions if necessary, one investor told Vail Resorts and Vermont officials in an email. The investor's name was redacted in the copy provided to the Denver Post. U.S. announces $50 billion plan to stave off wildfires by Matthew Brown and Jonathan Cooper, the Associated Press. Billings, Montana. The Biden administration said Tuesday it will significantly expand efforts to stave off catastrophic wildfires that have torched areas of the U.S. West by more aggressively thinning forests around hotspots where nature and neighborhoods collide. As climate change heats up and dries out the West, administration officials said they have crafted a $50 billion plan to more than double the use of controlled fires and logging to reduce trees and other vegetation that serves as tinder in the most at-risk areas. Only some of the work has funding so far. Projects will begin this year, and the plan will focus on regions where out-of-control blazes have wiped out neighborhoods and sometimes entire communities, including California's Sierra Nevada Mountains, the east side of the Rocky Mountains in Colorado, and portions of Arizona, Oregon, and Washington State. Homes keep getting built on fire-prone areas, even as conditions that stoke blazes get worse. You're going to have forest fires. The question is how catastrophic do those fires have to be, Agricultural Secretary Tom Vilsack told the Associated Press in an interview. The time to act is now if we want to ultimately, over time, change the trajectory of these fires. Specific projects weren't immediately released, and it's not clear who would pay for the full scope of work envisioned across almost 80,000 square miles, an area almost as large as Idaho. Much of that area is controlled by states, tribes, or is privately owned. Reaching that goal would require an estimated $20 billion over 10 years of work on national forests and $30 billion for work on other federal, state, tribal, and private lands, said Vilsack spokesperson Kate Waters. Vilsack acknowledged that the new effort will also require a paradigm shift within the U.S. Forest Service from an agency devoted to stamping out fires into one that uses that what some Native Americans call good fire on forests and rangeland to prevent even larger blazes. Forest Service planning documents indicate the work will focus on hotspots that make up only 10% of the fire-prone areas across the U.S., but accounted for 80% of risks to communities because of their population densities and locations. The recently passed federal infrastructure bill put a down payment on the initiative, about $3 billion over 5 years, that Vilsack said will get work done quickly. Wildfire expert John Abetsoglu said lessening fire dangers on the amount of land envisioned under the administration's plan is a lofty goal that represents even more acreage than burned over the past 10 years across the U.S. But Abetsoglu, a University of California Merced engineering professor, said the focus on wildfire hazards closest to the communities makes sense. Our scorecard for fire should be about lives saved rather than acres that didn't burn, he said. Vilsack joined Forest Service Chief Randy Moore to announce the plan during an event in Phoenix where he defended its scope as realistic. We know from a scientific standpoint precisely where this action has to take place in many of the forests in order to protect communities, in order to protect the people, Vilsack said. Following the announcement at the Desert Botanical Garden, a popular showcase for cactuses, desert trees, and other dry weather plants. Dealing with Western wildfires is becoming increasingly urgent as they get more destructive and intense. There have been rare winter blazes in recent weeks, including infernos in Montana and Colorado, where a wildfire on December 30th tore through a suburban area and destroyed more than 1,000 buildings, leaving one person dead and a second still missing. And there's no signs of a let-up in conditions that keep the risk of wildfires extremely high. A long-term mega-drought is gripping the region, and scientists forecast temperatures will keep rising as more climate-changing carbon emissions are pumped into the atmosphere. The impact stretches far beyond the western U.S. because massive smoke plumes at the height of wildfire season in the U.S. and Canada spread the health effects across North America, sending unhealthy pollution last summer to major cities from San Francisco to Philadelphia and Toronto. For decades, the primary approach to containing and extinguishing forest fires was to try to stamp them out. The efforts have been similar to massive military-like campaigns, including planes, fleets of heavy equipment, and thousands of firefighting personnel to support workers dispatched to the fire zones. However, fires are a part of the natural cycle for most forests, so putting them out leaves stands of trees that don't burn, surrounded by dead wood, underbrush, and other highly flammable fuels, a worst-case scenario when blazes ignite. Critics say the government's plan to use logging to reduce fire damages will hurt both forests and the wildlife and water supplies that depend on them. In South Dakota's Black Hills, for example, government biologists have said that too many trees dying from a combination of insects, fire, and logging have made current timber harvest levels unsustainable. The U.S. Forest Service simply cannot log its way out of the climate crisis, said Adam Rissian with the environmental group Wild Earth Guardians. But Vilsack said in a combination of tree thinning and intentional set fires to clear undergrowth that are called prescribed burns will make the forests healthier in the long run while reducing the threat to public safety. Forests thin near Lake Tahoe and its tourism gateway, the community of South Lake Tahoe, were credited with slowing the advance of the massive Caldor fire last summer that destroyed almost 800 homes and prompted evacuations of tens of thousands of residents and tourists. A similar phenomenon played out during Oregon's Bootleg fire last July, which burned more than 600 square miles, but did less damage in forests that was thinned over the past decade. We know this work, Vilsack says. It's removing some of the timber in a very scientific and thoughtful way so that you end up, at the end of the day, fires don't continue to hop from treetop to treetop, but eventually come to the ground where we can put them out. Now I'll be reading from the Denver Post obituaries. Andrew D. Herrera, November 11, 1933 to January 10, 2022. Andrew D. Herrera passed away peacefully on January 10, 2022, at the age of 88 at his home in Denver, Colorado, surrounded by his family and friends after a short illness. He will be greatly missed by his family, friends, and caregivers, many of whom were privileged to witness his strength, courage, and grace during the last few difficult days of his otherwise healthy and fruitful life. A viewing will be held at Olinger Highland Mortuary at 10201 North Grant Street, Thornton, Colorado, on Wednesday, January 19th, from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Andrew will be honored and his life celebrated at Holy Cross Catholic Church on Thursday, January 20th, 2022 at 12:30 p.m. with a rosary and viewing preceding the services from 11:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Please go to OlingerHighland.com for full obituary. Kenneth John Delmonico, Sr., September 24, 1935 to January 12, 2022. Rosary Friday, January 21st, 6:30 p.m. at Haran and McConaty, 3101 South Wadsworth Boulevard, Mass at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, January 22nd, Holy Name Catholic Church. Please visit full obituary at HaranCares.com. Glenn Hamilton, February 20th, 1936 to January 14th, 2022. Glenn Hamilton passed away peacefully on January 14th, 2022. He leaves behind his beloved wife of 65 years, four children, and six grandchildren. Please visit HaranCares.com for full obituary. Margaret Peggy O'Neill, February 13, 1930 to January 16, 2022, 91 of Denver. Funeral Mass on Friday, January 21st at 10 a.m. at Haran and McConaty, 11150 East Dartmouth Avenue, Aurora, Colorado, 80014. Carol Jean Quimby Parenteau, December 23rd, 1942 to December 29th, 2021. Andrew Rej Andrzejczyk, August 25th, 1929 to January 9th, 2022. A visitation will be held at 5 p.m., followed by a rosary at 6 p.m. on Thursday, January 20th at Haran and McConaty, 11150 East Dartmouth Avenue in Aurora. A funeral mass will be held on Friday, January 21st at 10 a.m. at Risen Christ Catholic Church at 3060 South Monaco Parkway, Denver. Andy will be laid to rest in Fort Logan National Cemetery. Betty Jane Woods of Denver passed away peacefully in her sleep on January 11, 2022 at the age of 95. A career nurse, Betty was born in Newton, New Jersey on November 14, 1926 and had lived in Denver since 1951. Betty graduated from Newton High School and earned her diploma in nursing at Hackensack Hospital. After relocating to Colorado early in her career, she added a BS in nursing from CU Boulder to her RN degree. Over the years, Betty's nursing roles included working in the medical surgical unit at St. Luke's Hospital, then as an operating nurse and in nursing management, completing her career at St. Anthony's Central in Denver. She considered one of her greatest accomplishments to be when she and three nursing friends built an entire 18 by 20 foot log cabin near Bailey, Colorado, using only hand tools. Known locally as the Nurse's Cabin, the After Hours project took 5 years to complete. Once Betty retired from nursing in 1986, she continued to provide care as an active volunteer for the Society of St. Vincent de Paul and a traveling Eucharistic minister for many years. Betty was a resident of the gardens at St. Elizabeth, where she was all in with gardening, excursions, event planning, and creative activities like photography and card making to send to family and friends. Betty is survived by brothers Don, wife Peg of Lewes, Delaware, and Bob, wife Nancy of Newton, New Jersey. Nieces and nephews of Linda Brickley, husband John of San Diego, California. Deborah Modlin, husband Glenn of Jupiter, Florida. Jan Pollitt of Kingston, New York. Kelly Lynch, husband Joe of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Dave Woods of Newton, New Jersey. Whitney Brimmer, husband Jim of Westfield, New Jersey. Christy Minkowitz, husband Jim of Newton. Kim McCullough of Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, and Greg Woods of Essex Fells, New Jersey. Grandnieces, nephews, Amy Thide, husband Jeremy, Colleen Minkowitz, Cameron Brimmer, Leah Brimmer, Quinn McCullough, Emily McCullough, Abigail Woods, Brooke Woods, and Madison Woods, and great-grandnephew Drew Thide. Betty was predeceased by parents James R. Woods, Sr. and Margaret Longcoy Woods and brother James R. Woods, Jr. A memorial service will be held on Thursday, January 20th at 3 p.m. in the chapel at Gardens of St. Elizabeth, 2835 West 32nd Avenue in Denver. COVID screening, vaccine, and masks required. A graveside ceremony will take place in Newton, New Jersey at a future date. Donations in Betty's memory may be made to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Denver Conference, Denver Metro Council, 2830 Lawrence Street, Denver, Colorado, 80205. Now I'll be reading some miscellaneous articles from the Denver Post. January 6th panel, Giuliani, three other Trump allies are subpoenaed. By Farnoosh Amiri and Colleen Long, the Associated Press, Washington. The House Committee investigating the U.S. Capitol insurrection issued subpoenas Tuesday to Rudy Giuliani and other members of Donald Trump's legal team who filed bogus legal challenges to the 2020 election that fueled the lie that the race had been stolen from the former president. The committee is continuing to widen its scope into Trump's orbit, this time demanding information and testimony from Giuliani, Jenna Ellis, Sidney Powell, and Boris Effenstein. All four publicly pushed Trump's baseless voter fraud claims in the months after the election. The four individuals we've subpoenaed today advanced unsupported theories about election fraud, pushed efforts to overturn the election results, or were in direct contact with the former president about attempts to stop the counting of electoral votes, Mississippi Rep. Benny Thompson, Democratic chair of the panel, said in a statement. Effenstein, in a tweet, called the committee's illegitimate and its efforts part of a witch hunt against Trump and its supporters. The others who were subpoenaed did not respond to messages seeking comment. Trump's legal team sought to overturn the election results in the battleground states by filing lawsuits alleging widespread irregularities with ballots and claims by partisan poll watchers who said they couldn't see everything going on because of precautions taken as a result of COVID-19 pandemic. More than 50 lawsuits were filed, mostly in battleground states. The lawsuits were soundly battled down in the courts, sometimes within days of filing. But the legal challenges and the multiple press conferences held by Giuliani and others helped galvanize Trump supporters behind the idea that the election had been stolen, even though Trump's own attorney general said there was no evidence of widespread fraud, and local officials said it had been the most secure election in history. The committee said in its seeking records and deposition testimony from Giuliani, the 76-year-old former New York City mayor over his promotion of election fraud claims on behalf of Trump. The panel is also seeking information about Giuliani's reported efforts to persuade state legislators to take steps to overturn the election results. 4 days after the November 3rd, 2020 election, while the Associated Press and other media outlets were calling hit for Joe Biden, Giuliani held a press conference at a landscaping company in Philadelphia to announce his team plan to challenge the election results. It was the beginning of a pressure campaign to allot electoral votes in battleground states where Biden won over Trump instead. Ellison Powell also appeared with Giuliani at press conferences pushing false claims of election fraud, and Giuliani met with local elected officials to push false theories about corrupt voting systems. Powell was eventually removed from the team after she said in an interview she was going to release the Kraken of lawsuits. Big voting bill faces defeat as two Dems won't stop filibuster, by Lisa Mascaro, the Associated Press. Washington. Voting legislation that Democrats and civil rights leaders say is vital for protecting democracy appeared headed for defeat as the Senate churned into debate Tuesday, a devastating setback enabled by President Joe Biden's own party as two holdout senators refused to support rule changes to overcome a Republican filibuster. The Democratic senators, Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona and Joe Manchin of West Virginia, faced strong criticism from black leaders and civil rights organizations for failing to take on what critics call the Jim Crow filibuster. The debate carries echoes of an earlier era when the Senate filibuster was deployed in lengthy speeches by opponents of civil rights legislation. It comes as Democrats and other voting advocates nationwide warn that Republican-led states are passing laws making it more difficult for black Americans and others to vote by consolidating polling locations, requiring certain types of identifications, and ordering other changes. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer acknowledged the current bill's likely defeat this week, but he said the fight is not over as he heads advocates call to force all senators to go on record with their positions. "We ain't giving up," Schumer said in an evening strategy meeting. "It's a fight for the soul and future of America." This is the fifth time the Senate will try to pass voting legislation this Congress. The Freedom to Vote John R. Lewis Act combines earlier bills into one package that would make Election Day a national holiday, ensure access to early voting and mail-in ballots, which have become especially popular during the COVID-19 pandemic, and enable the Justice Department to intervene in states with a history of voter interference, among other changes. Both Manchin and Sinema say to support the package which has passed the House, but they are unwilling to change the Senate rules to muscle it through the chamber over Republican objections. With a 50-50 split, Democrats have a narrow Senate majority. Vice President Kamala Harris can break a tie, but they lack the 60 votes needed to overcome the GOP filibuster. Instead, Schumer announced the Senate will vote on a more specific rule change for a talking filibuster on this one bill, requiring senators to stand at their desks and argue their views rather than the current practice that simply allows senators to privately signal their objections. Initial voting could start as soon as Wednesday, but even the proposal for a talking filibuster is expected to fail, since Manchin and Sinema have said they are unwilling to change the rules for party line vote by Democrats alone. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, who led his party in doing away with the filibuster's 60-vote threshold for Supreme Court nominees during Donald Trump's presidency, warned of changing the rules again. He said Tuesday would break the Senate. Democratic senators countered in speeches from the Senate floor that the Republicans objecting to the voting legislation, they have no choice. Manchin did open the door to a more tailored package of voting law changes that he said in a bipartisan group of senators are working on and could draw Republican support. "There are so many things that we can agree on," he said, though he held firm against voting to change the filibuster rules. The secret sauce. Red Boat fish sauce chef on must-have umami ingredient for Vietnamese cooking, by Jessica Yadagaran, Bay Area News Group. As a young child, Viet-born Diep Tran shopped with her grandparents in the markets of Little Saigon and Orange County. And every weekend, her elders would inevitably stand and stare disappointedly at the walls of condiments, shaking their heads and mumbling that nothing available here was even close to the dish-transforming fish sauces back home. That changed in 2011 when a determined ex-Apple engineer launched Red Boat Fish Sauce. Instantly embraced by culinary titans like David Chang and Andrea Nguyen, Quang Pham's sauce was the first premium sustainably sourced fish sauce made using centuries-old fermentation process and only two ingredients, black anchovies and salt from the island of Phu Quoc in Vietnam. The sauce is produced and packaged at Red Boat's factory in Hayward, California. Tran, a Los Angeles chef, was among the earliest adopters. After one taste, she purchased multiple cases of the amber, intensely fragrant, first-pressed sauce and recalibrated all of her recipes, pho, curry, porridge, and more, to this one ingredient. I was an evangelical about it, recalls Tran, now the R&D chef for Red Boat. I touched my grandparents' Catholic medallion that I wear and said, "Props to you, Grandma. I get you now." Himself drove those cases down to L.A. and quickly developed a friendship with Tran. Now together with Tran's girlfriend, the writer Tien Nguyen, they have released the Red Boat Fish Sauce Cookbook, beloved recipes from the family behind the purest fish sauce. The book chronicles Pham's many journeys, his year-long journey from Vietnam to America, following the war, and later his journeys back to his home country, beginning in 2006 to recreate the flavors missing in his favorite childhood dishes. The book delves into the art of making fish sauce from the evaporation ponds where the salt is harvested to the barrel house at Phu Quoc, known as the Champagne of Fish Sauce for its ideal fermenting environment. There, wild anchovies are caught, immediately salted, and fermented for more than a year. The cookbook includes 100-plus recipes from Pham's childhood, his current weeknight family table, newly developed Red Boat recipes, and contributions from some of the many chefs who are obsessed with the sauce. Tran, who developed the recipe, shares the secrets to superior banh mi and thịt khô tí, braised black pepper pork, and how fish sauce can transform roast chicken, burgers, and marinara, and is the perfect substitute for hard cheese and pesto. In writing the cookbook, it was important to Tran to showcase both Vietnamese and American dishes, and not just savory appetizers, salads, and braises, but breakfast staples, like her good girl dinette cured bacon, desserts, and drinks too. We wanted to reflect that people, no matter what their ethnicity, do not just cook their own food, she says. We're putting fish sauce in everything. Tran was tasked with recreating Pham's mother's recipes. She passed away in 2012, a year after she watched her son succeed in his quest to bring premium fish sauce to America. And her recipe notebooks, two of four found their way to the states after the war, are Pham family treasures. It was fun for me, Tran says. Her script looked a lot like my grandma's, neat and upright. Some of her recipes were detailed, others were very general. It was all a mnemonic device for her. Tran updated mom's ga que, roast chicken, traditionally cooked on the stove, with an overnight marinated version that is butterflied and cooked in the oven. But Tran's tribute to banh kin, a coconut fish soup found in Phu Quoc, appears untouched. Its complex flavors are achieved by that thoughtful layering of components and textures that makes Vietnamese cuisine so magical. Most recently, Tran and Pham have worked with local farms and Phu Quoc to bring other products to market, including Red Boat palm sugar, black peppercorn, and chef salts. For Tran, however, traveling to Phu Quoc, her first time back in Vietnam since she was six has been one of the most rewarding experiences of this culinary journey. Fish sauce is something that most consumers experience just as an end product. So to stand with Quang at the banks of the Red Boat Barrel House was an absolute unforgettable experience, she says. What struck me the most was watching his fishing boats return to the loading dock and seeing the crew transfer by hand a literal boatful of salted anchovies to barrels where they will ferment for 12 months before becoming the amber fish sauce that we will eventually see on supermarket shelves. And that would have made her grandparents smile with approval. Two new Denver bars that seem like vacation in January by Josie Sexton, the Denver Post. You deserve a vacation this month, but if you're like me, you aren't taking one because the holidays were expensive, because Omicron still surges, and because there just isn't any time for that. Enter two new Denver destinations where you can at least feel transported for a night. One will take you to Paris by the way of Montreal, and the other will give you a taste of Oaxaca and Mexico City all in one bite. Cantina Loca. This is the Denver tasting room and bar for Chef Dana Rodriguez's own Dona Loca spirits brand. Rodriguez launched her mezcal and tequila line in 2021 and has been planning this Cantina extension of it, her first solo restaurant project all along. This concept is my dream, Rodriguez said in a release. It's the ultimate representation of Mexican culture through food and drink in an atmosphere that feels like a true Mexico City Cantina. Why make the trip? If you've been to Rodriguez's restaurants, Work in Class and Super Mega Bien, or even if you haven't, you'll want to check out this latest addition to the family. It's a casual cantina with an artistic street. Local builders Finn Art furnished the space on the ground floor of the Lohi Extended Stay, and muralist John Rumtum warmed up the concrete walls and brickwork with a loving ode to the agave plant. Order like a local. There are plenty of agave spirit-based cocktails to order. See requisite palomas and margaritas. But you should also peruse the menu of Aguas Benditas so you can sip the house brand mezcal on its own in three distinct styles. And also try traditional Mexican spirits such as Reyesilla and Sotol. See also tacos and snacks such as tempura cactus or nopales fritas and stuffed corn sopes or picaditas vegetarianas. Afo Brasserie. You meet a former Rhino food hall stall that's all grown up and sophisticated in Washington Park. Meet a former, this French-inspired restaurant started out at Zeppelin Station in 2018, but recently advanced to a brick-and-mortar space next door to Uncle Ramen on Pennsylvania Street. And the two businesses make for great date-night neighbors, depending on your mood. At the Brasserie, owners Jared and Amanda Leonard were inspired by Montreal's food scene. We ate our way through Montreal while researching the au pho concept and fell in love with the French culture in the city, Jaron Leonard said in a release. We are particularly inspired by restaurants like Joe Beef and Au Pied du Cochon. Why make the trip? It's hard to recognize this space that was once occupied by a burger shop. Now it's all velvet seating and art deco decor with the air of a Parisian sitting room. Pair that with a barbecue master's expert food, which includes a mix of French and Canadian influences. See Beef Bourguignon and House Poutine, and you'll start to see why the Leonards are calling it a casually indulgent after-work escape. Thank you for joining us for the Wednesday Denver Post edition of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head.